Some fast food companies would have you believe that it's no longer possible for an American family to cook a meal for under $10. But Josh Fattel, the new president of Slow Food USA, is out to prove them wrong. And he says that not only is slow food good food, it can also be affordable. Josh Fattel joins me now in the Jerome L. Green Performance Space, along with our show regular, Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Welcome to our show.
Great to be here. It's beautiful, this
isn't this an
space.
Incredible space?
It's amazing, yes.
Well, Ruth, we've decided to only have you come by in the space because you like it so much. Josh,
right?
Before you became president of Slow Food, you were the co-director of the Yale Sustainable Food Project. How did that come about? And did Yale know that you'd gone to Harvard?
Yale had heard, they asked me, and I told them I went to a mediocre school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they actually figured out what that meant. I got to the Yale Project really through Alice Waters, who was pushing the university to get good local organic food in the dining halls, and had heard about some students who were pushing for the same. And she said, you should really move to New Haven. And there are very few people who could have gotten me to move to New Haven, and she's one of them. So I wrote them a letter and said, I'd like to come and help you figure out how to do this.
And what turned out to be the Yale Sustainable Food Project?
Well, 4 years later, we had a beautiful, vibrant organic garden on campus with a wood-fired pizza oven and a post and beam pavilion students had raised, made out of timber from the Yale Forest. We had over 30 classes related to food and agriculture and the environment for undergraduates. Orientation programs where students would go, the first thing they got to campus as freshmen, they would go out to local farms and work and make their best friends and also learn where their food actually came from. And a whole host of programs for undergrads about food, agriculture, and the environment.
Did you visit the farm?
I did. And one of the things that really impressed me about it, I think the first thing that you told me about the farm after, you know, walking me through it was about the connections you'd made with the farmers and how important that had been for the university. That, and then I met some of the farmers who talked about how great it had been for them to make this relationship with the university so they had a guaranteed client. And so it was something that worked for the whole community. And I think one of the things that's really important about the whole farmer relationship is about making it a whole community and bringing food into the community and the community into food.
Well, Yale is in the middle of a farming area, and yet I suspect they were bringing things in from Cisco Systems or some other regular supplier.
Yeah, it's incredible. You can be such a good neighbor and completely change your landscape, or you can be completely indifferent as a neighbor. And their change to buying local and sustainable food really changed the lives of a lot of farmers. We went, but not just farmers, we went with our salsa, which is a very popular condiment in college. You go through about 25,000 pounds a year. We went to a local farmer and asked him to grow our tomatoes and onions and some jalapenos and cilantro. And he did, and it totally changed his economic model. He was able to count on that. His kid decided to stay on the farm and take it on. And it was because of one of 6,000 ingredients. But then what was cool is we had to make salsa. So we went to a local processing place. And they were laying people off at that point. And we said, will you help us turn these tomatoes into salsa? And they did. And then we went to a local print shop and said, will you print on recycled paper with soy-based inks? And so they got some business, too, and also changed their practices. So through the whole supply chain, you're doing good instead of doing harm.
And this farmer actually told me that he was able to lower his prices because he knew going into the beginning of the year, he knew what he was going to be making. And so that it all came around. And, you know, one of the things we're talking about is cost here.
And cutting down risk.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If he had rain 3 Saturdays in a row, that could have meant food stamps because his farmers markets would be washed out. And instead, he was leasing land in a part of Connecticut where development was really taking out a lot of farmland and turning it into box stores, keeping that land in sustainable agriculture and becoming more economically stable.
Weren't you a farmer at one point, Josh?
I was for a little while. I took some time off at Harvard. I told my advisor, I'm going to go to southern Italy and work as an agricultural laborer. And he said, I strongly advise you not to do that.
Well, you also wound up shearing sheep, didn't you?
Yeah, I went.
That's a little more than just growing tomatoes.
Yeah, I made cheese and ricotta, and I herded sheep and did some foraging, hoed grapes, picked lemons, was basically a migrant laborer for a little while. And then when I got back, I started growing food in a greenhouse at the university, and after that did start my own small farm.
And where did this desire come from? You didn't grow up on a farm, did you?
I didn't at all, no. I don't know, but I think it's a fairly innate desire.
Because most farmers really grow up in a farming community. And the big problem is so many of them wind up leaving because it's so difficult. We don't get too many city kids going and starting farms, do we?
Well, it's an incredible time. That's totally changing. So the number of internship applications for learning how to farm for college graduates just skyrocketed. Young people are going back and taking over land that other people are letting go. And they grew up in intellectual families in urban areas. They grew up with parents who had manufacturing jobs, and they're deciding that they want to go back to the land.
And one of the most popular things that kids do these days when they take gap years is woofing, which is, you know, going around the world working on farms.
So the sort of thing that the Chinese government forced on people during the Cultural Revolution is now...
Well, it's one thing when it's forced on you, and it's another thing when you do it because it's what you want to do.
When did you become aware of slow food, Ruth?
Because I'm friends with Alice, pretty much, I think, at the point that she did. So it's been a while, and, you know, I was very aware of that movement in Italy. And
Carlo Petrini started it through a pasta-eating protest in front of the Spanish Steps. That's because a McDonald's had been... Or was it a Burger King that's at the Spanish Steps?
And I think it was a McDonald's, and it was the idea of, you know... If fast food is going to invade our country, we're going to champion slow food. And, it was something that picked up steam very quickly in Italy. And Carlo is a politician, so he knows how to make things pick up steam. But when it came to this country, it was much slower.
Well, it was slow foods. What do you expect? Slow. It was slower because Americans were more resistant to the idea. Well, there was that tradition in Europe, and I'm sure even though the McDonald's at the foot of the Spanish Steps is quite popular with Italians, I thought most of the people I saw in there were Italians, still there is this long tradition, and I could see where the resistance would be a lot stronger there.
And I think it's also the idea of the patrimony. I mean, this is what our culture is in Italy, and I think it's only recently that Americans have started realizing that this nation began as a nation of farmers. And only now are we sort of starting to understand that it's time for us to take back our heritage. And that, I actually think the fate of the nation probably depends on that.
Well, in Italy, as I remember initially, it was known for these long, elaborate meals, a lot of wine flowing, cheese, staying up until dawn talking about philosophy.
I don't think farmers
everybody in this
stay
room
up till
loves
dawn.
Doing that. Well, have you found it easier to sell the concept of slow food?
Well, I think that America has a food culture that's really profound, and we forget that food culture doesn't just mean white tablecloths and great wine. We have the church supper. We have the whole hog barbecue to support the volunteer fire department. We have this incredible culture of immigrants who bring food cultures with them, and it's about that. This movement for sustainable food, for food that's good, clean, and fair, is about that food culture in this country. It's not about restaurants.
My guests are Josh Vertel and Ruth Reichel. We're talking about slow food and related matters because there are a lot of food issues that we're going to address. One of them is Slow Foods Project Arc of Taste that seeks to prevent the extinction of heritage foods. We're starting to see more and more variety, diversity in our grain markets, but there has been a real problem in recent years, hasn't there? One kind of potato, the sort of thing that led to the potato famine in mm-hmm. Ireland, was pretty much the same, the norm in the United States.
That's absolutely right. And I made friends with a cab driver the other day who's from Peru, and we were talking about the potato from his town. Peru has literally hundreds of varieties.
Well, that's
of
where
potatoes.
Potatoes started in yep. the Andes.
And so they have all of these varieties, and I said, do you miss potatoes here? And he said, well, they have potatoes here. And I said, no, but do you miss the potato from your town here? And he said, yeah, I do. And I went back 4 years ago, and I was able to have it. And we've had some success, some really remarkable success, bringing back breeds that were at the verge of extinction in partnership with some other great organizations like the American Livestock Breed Conservancy. And if you think about heritage turkeys, you can now get heritage turkeys, bourbon reds and slates in Whole Foods leading up to Thanksgiving. And that's been a remarkable shift and has changed the way biology spreads its information around for that poultry. And we're going to see the same thing happen with chickens soon, with a new variety coming out that's an old variety that's coming back called the Buckeye chicken. And you've seen it with pork, with heritage breeds. But what's really important to me is that's an important project, but it's important that at a certain point, the work of the sustainable food movement be accessible to all people. So the big problems in our food system right now from the perspective of a lot of Americans is not that they eat the same turkey variety, it's that their kids are going to grow up diabetic. So we need to find a way to do that important work around biodiversity while still really addressing these deep, deep problems in our food system that impact people.
Well, yesterday, Sunday, 60 Minutes repeated their segment about Alice Waters, and Leslie Stahl asked the question that they always ask Alice, and I'm sure they asked the two of you as well, isn't this elitist? In fact, I can almost guarantee you that no matter what you say, I'm going to get some emails later from listeners going to say, this is all elitist, this food is much too expensive, they're trying to force something on us that we don't really need.
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is that the big answer to all of this is much bigger than all of us. I mean, it is our government policy which supports the wrong foods. And the reason that you have this constant dichotomy between fast food and slow food is that we are supporting fast food.
So we subsidize certain foods, and we don't subsidize. If we subsidize the kinds of foods that you're talking about, they would be less expensive.
They would be affordable. If we subsidized farmers, if we, encourage people to eat vegetables, if we subsidize that instead of corn, industrial corn, this food would then be affordable, and this question wouldn't even come up. I mean, the answer to this is that it's the wrong question.
Mm-hmm. Well, why are we subsidizing those things? Because they are made by agribusiness, which has lobbying clout than small farmers?
The largest lobby in Washington, I believe.
The way I would think of it is food that's good for you, food that's good for the environment, food that's good for the people who grow it and fair to the people who pick it, that's not a privilege. That's a universal right. And the fact that right now, food that doesn't make your kids sick, food that doesn't hurt the environment, food that's fair to the people who grow and pick it, is hard for people to afford in this country, is a question about justice. It's a justice question, not a privilege or values question. And we need to do the work to make structural changes to our food system that makes it so that everyone can eat that food.
Less than a week into your term as Slow Food USA's new president, you addressed the 800 members of your organization at Terra Madre and said that you were going to change this organization so that it's not just about pleasure and that we're going to become a social justice organization. Why social justice? What does that have to do with food?
Well, everything. I mean, if you look at any of the major problems in our country right now, whether they're healthcare problems, whether they're problems of the environment, climate change or other, whether it's public education, whether it's the economy, all of those problems that are priorities now, priorities because we're in crisis, disproportionately hurt poor people, they disproportionately hurt people of color, and they're all at root, in part, caused by the food we eat and the way it's produced. So if we're a food organization that thinks the food should be good, clean, and fair, we cannot possibly do this work and just be focused on pleasure.
We think of Yes We Can as being something that Barack Obama coined, but actually, wasn't it Cesar Chavez?
Yes, I actually wrote a little article about that. A lot of the language and imagery in the Obama campaign really was based on agrarian movements in the U.S., and Chavez said, si se puede, when he was pushing for unionization.
Oh, well, he said it in Spanish, that's why I didn't know.
Si se puede, and it was translated, which is a good move, because I think it wouldn't have worked otherwise. But even if you look at the logo, Those are agrarian fields that speak of hope recently plowed. It's a beautiful, beautiful image. And the reason hope and change are there is because it's about tilling fields that will give prosperity later.
Well, you've said that environmental degradation is most often human degradation. So not only do we have to worry about poisoning our foods with pesticides, but we should think about who picked the food as well?
Absolutely. Both Ruth and I have been fairly actively involved with an organization called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And I was down in Immokalee, Florida recently, where roughly 90% of the tomatoes we grow, we eat in the wintertime are grown. And I got up at 4 in the morning to go and get work with some of the workers there who picked those tomatoes. And they spotted me, so I wasn't able to get any work. But I learned that since 78, they haven't had a wage increase. They make roughly $9,000 a year. They pay rent, like I pay in Park Slope, for trailers where they pack people in on bare mattresses. And in the last 10 years, they've had 7 cases of slavery, people who've been put in jail for breaking the laws that we put in place to abolish slavery.
Who are these people? Are they immigrants, or are they people who were born into this environment who don't know about any other kind of way that the world should be?
Right now, the workers there are mainly immigrants, though there have been periods of time where they were not immigrants. So some of these slavery cases were people with American passports who found themselves in tough situations and were taken advantage of. And what's amazing is this organization has actually gone to fast food companies and gotten them to sign on to agreements to give fairer wages to them. Right now, so they've gotten wins with McDonald's, with Burger King, with Taco Bell. They've gotten wins with Whole Foods. Right now, they're in a pitched battle with Chipotle, trying to get them to sign an agreement. And for me, it was a revelation, the idea that we've been working on getting growers to plant different varieties of tomatoes, and we didn't focus on the people who were picking the bulk of the tomatoes we actually eat in the winter.
Is this why tomatoes remain relatively inexpensive? Is that the other side of the coin?
Yeah, it's a big piece of it, though you could give fair wages to the people who pick them without making them
The fight
expensive.
That they've had is for 1 penny a pound. I mean, this isn't going to break any of us. And it makes a huge difference to these workers. And, you know, it's a much bigger issue than just is it going to make tomatoes more expensive.
Well, I've decided to grow my own, and my first tomatoes are coming up on my right. my deck. I have some cherry tomatoes that had just turned red, and the other tomatoes are still yellow, but I don't know. If it keeps on raining like this, I'm going to have big, juicy, maybe not so tasty
yeah,
tomatoes.
Watery tomatoes.
But I'm looking forward to eating every one of them. We have to take a little break, and we will be back with Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and Josh Vertel, who is the new president of Slow Food USA. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And we're back at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space. We have a wonderful audience here, and we have people walking by and not paying any attention. Oh, there's a guy who's looking in the window. Isn't that nice? Oh, I think he works for WNYC, so he... on the stage here with me are Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and Josh Vertel, who is the new president of Slow Food USA. And Slow Food, as we said, has been expanding its mandate and looking at all sorts of other things beyond promoting the traditional food approaches, fairness for workers and the like. We were talking about the situation with the creation of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Does the situation in Florida mean that you're not going to be eating tomatoes from Florida anymore?
Well, it changed the way I look at it. And yeah, it has meant that for me. I'm not a person who eats in fast food joints that much.
But January, the only decent tomatoes you can get are the ones that are trucked up from Florida.
Well, these ones are actually not decent. I mean, they're not decent just from a taste perspective. They're picked
these
green.
These are the indecent ones from
these
Florida.
Are indecent tomatoes. And they're indecent because they're picked green and they're gassed in a truck on the way up to ripen up. And they don't taste like much. They have that mealy sort of styrofoamy taste to them.
And they're also indecent because, I mean, how good slaves. Can you feel about eating food that was picked by slaves? I mean, you
right.
shouldn't feel good about that.
Right, even if it were delicious.
Even if it were the most delicious thing on earth, you shouldn't feel good about it.
And this is the thing. So most often, it not being delicious, it being dependent on human degradation, and it being linked to incredible environmental degradation, those things go hand in hand. And having been there, having been with those workers, talked with them, made friends with them, and seen the conditions they live in, it became completely unappealing. It wasn't a moral stance I took. It was just an aesthetic one. I couldn't imagine enjoying it.
Today's Times has an article, the Well article deals with getting kids to eat good food. And this is something that Slow Food's been involved with as well, largely, I assume, because of Alice Waters' efforts. But We have Jamie Oliver in England trying to do the same thing. Is this a worldwide movement, getting kids to grow food and cook it and eat something other than cheeseburgers?
It is a worldwide movement, and Alice does get a lot of the credit because she's done amazing work around it, but the truth is I think it's a movement of moms and dads and teachers and also the kids themselves. So we've seen young kids advocating in their schools to get gardens. So I spoke with a 10-year-old girl when I was in Atlanta recently who had written a letter to the USDA saying, I want my school to have a garden. So it's everyone's movement, and it's exploding all over the country.
Problem is, in many schools, like the school I went to, it was hard enough that they stole the playground to put in more classrooms, mm-hmm. So there was no space for a garden. On the Slow Food USA blog, Debbie Lehman writes that many school cafeterias are forced to operate like fast food businesses because fast food is what kids want to buy. Are there ways to change that?
I mean, the idea that fast food is what kids want to buy because that's what we've trained them. I mean, the thing that we keep forgetting is that we train children to eat. I mean, Japanese children don't grow up liking fish and vegetables because they're genetically different than American children. They grow up because that's what they see people eating. And changing the way children eat has a lot to do with changing the way we all eat. I mean, children do what they're raised to do.
And we outsource our education to the food companies. I mean, when I worked at Yale and we were changing the dining services, we couldn't get Coke out for two reasons. One was that there was a 5-year exclusive contract with Coke, and that they sold Coke at a loss to the university because they knew that a young customer was a customer for life. The other was that literally built into the walls of this institution were the pipes that moved the syrup and the soda from the basement kitchen up to the servery. So you couldn't get a drink in a dining hall without it being a Coca-Cola product. And if you wanted water, you had to find the magical little button next to the Coke that you pushed that wasn't even labeled. So drinking something that wasn't full of environmental degradation, bad for you, you had to know a secret. And even as you did it, there was a backlit label above it that was branded with Coca-Cola products. So the idea we'd outsource our education to kids and then ask them what they want to eat, outsource our education around food to companies and then ask our kids what they want to eat is, to me, completely mad.
Many schools, in fact, get some of their funding from selling the rights to sell Snapple or Coke or Pepsi or some other soft drink.
I mean, this argument just drives me crazy, this notion that we have to feed fast food to children because it's the only thing that they will eat. It's abnegating responsibility as adults. We're the grown-ups. I
mean, so why have we come to this pass? Why has the is this a problem with the federal government? Is this local school boards?
It's sort of everything. I mean, it's such a systemic problem. It's local school boards who are strapped for money, and we say to them, well, you know, go to the soft drink companies and get your money, which is a very bad idea. We pay for it down the road. And, you know, we have to accept the fact that there is a bill coming due, and we don't want to accept that fact.
So this bill that has to pass by the end of September, right now it's written in a way where kids' lunch is reimbursed to the schools. The schools have a dollar amount, $2.57, to provide the whole meal, and that includes overhead, it includes rent, it includes labor, and it leaves less than a dollar for ingredients. So if you think about what you can teach on a dollar a day for lunch, you can teach that food is either sweet or salty, you can teach brand recognition. You can certainly not teach that there's a connection between land and food and responsibility, and you can make kids sick, and that's exactly what we're doing.
And the School Nutrition Association is calling for an increase from 257 to 292. Doesn't sound like all that much, but Alice Waters has been campaigning for a long time to increase the budget to $5 per child, which would cost our government roughly $27 billion a year. I just can't, even though it probably would be really good for the kids, because that would also mean building real kitchens. I suspect you're not going to get Congress to do that sort of thing.
I see a dollar more.
We have Iraq to pay for, don't we?
We have health care to pay for, primarily. And Obama's speech that was recently published included an incredible quote. He said that reducing health care costs means cutting down on all the junk food that is fueling an epidemic of obesity, putting far too many Americans, young and old, at greater risk of costly chronic conditions. That's a lesson Michelle and I have tried to instill in our daughters with the White House vegetable garden that Michelle planted. And that's a lesson that we should work with local school districts to incorporate into their school lunch programs. So the school lunch program is a down payment on healthcare reform. And we can't afford not to change it at this point.
On the other hand, we have KFC running a commercial last fall that said American families can no longer cook their own meals for under $10.
Well, that's nonsense. I mean, American families can cook their meals for under $10, but it means cooking. I mean, it means not starting with things that are already prepared. And one of the things I would like to see happen is, you know, vocational education has got a very bad name in America these days, but I would like to see schools teaching people to cook again, because one of the ways that you can feed yourself reasonably is by knowing how to cook, by knowing how to balance, you know, protein in beans and rice, and maybe eating less meat, which is less expensive but more time consuming. Learning about, you know, edible weeds. I mean, there are tons of things that are growing out there that are free. Wonderful vegetables like lamb's quarters, which are growing throughout all our parks here in New York.
And epazote, the Mexican spice, grows wild all along our streets. Did you know that?
And purslane comes up through the cracks in the sidewalk. I mean, all of these are nutritious and very delicious.
On the other hand, anybody who's gone into certain supermarkets in the city knows that not everybody is treated equally, and there's some pretty bad stuff available in some of the poorer areas. And it's expensive as well.
A friend of mine named Kurt Fries, who lives in Iowa, took the KFC challenge. And he went to the supermarket in his town in Iowa. He said, I could go to the farmer's market and get a pastured chicken, and I could call up the guy with a mill who I know who does organic flour, but I'm just going to go and see what a regular person would do if they wanted to cook fried chicken for their family and biscuits. And he whooped them. And he laid it out in a entry on Grist that you can probably still find, where he had ingredients left over to cook for the week. He made chicken stock when he was done. I mean, he really took them to the mat and had money left over above what he would have spent if he had gone to KFC.
He made a KFC meal, chicken, four biscuits, mashed potatoes, and gravy for $7.94.
With flour left over for biscuits for next week.
Mm-hmm. And three pieces of chicken and a carcass for use in a soup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You do your research, man.
But that... I guess that involves planning, that involves really thinking things through, and some people don't want to be bothered. But you're saying there's always a trade-off.
Well, there's always a trade-off, and, you know, we made a big trade-off over the last 40 years where for the last 40 years we've spent roughly 25% of our budget on healthcare and food combined. It's been 25% for the whole time, but we flip-flopped over the 25 years from spending, you know, roughly 18% on food to spending under 9% on food. The healthcare has been the difference. So that's a story of shifting priorities. It's also a story of us eating less good food and getting really sick. Now, if I have a budget and I say, well, I'm going to spend this much on food and healthcare, I could eat well and be healthy, or I could eat poorly and be sick. It seems crazy that as a nation we've decided to set up a system where all we can do is eat poorly and be sick.
How much of this goes out of family experience? Ruth, you've talked about what a bad cook your mother was. And I guess the story of most people is they either do what their parents did or they do the opposite of what their parents did. You went in the opposite direction. But the food has to taste good for people to want to do this sort of thing and put the little extra effort in.
It does. And you bring up an interesting point, which is I think one of the problems, I mean, one of the reasons that we aren't learning to cook is that, you know, kids don't see their parents cooking. But it's also, I mean, we used to grow up in villages, and there was always a grandmother or an aunt or somebody who cooked. And I think one of the ways we counter this notion of I don't have time to cook is we stop thinking about cooking in nuclear family units, and we start thinking about maybe in an apartment floor, people trade off, and somebody cooks for three or four families every night. And so you get kids learning from a lot of different people who are cooking. You get a lot of different kinds of recipes. And, you know, it's not one mother cooking dinner every night. I mean, we really have to think creatively about how we solve this problem.
It is interesting that we're talking about cooking at home, but some of the people at the forefront of all of this discussion are the chefs. People like Peter Hoppen, who was here before, Dan Barber, and any number of others who have really been talking about changing the way we think about food.
Well, I mean, in this country, you know, we changed what the definition of a chef was first. I mean, I remember when a chef stopped being somebody who went to work at 12 and, you know, by peeling potatoes, and started being people who were passionate cooks who were educated. And the chefs, you know, went after the farmers and got them to start growing foods. I mean, the chefs have been at the forefront of this revolution for, you know, this new American food revolution, which started in the late 60s. It has been the chefs leading the way.
Alice Waters, I forgot to mention her as being at the forefront, and she is a chef. So are they among your strongest supporters at Slow Food USA?
Absolutely. I mean, chefs get it, and they start getting it because of taste. They want to track down the best tasting food. That's their job. The ones who really care about their job and have a developed palate try to do that. And then as they do that, they learn the stories behind their food, and they start asking, well, what are the stories behind this other food? What are the stories behind the norm? And those are stories you can't really hear without wanting to do something about it afterwards. And so some of them become activists too. And that helps to drive us, particularly because of celebrity culture. For me, I think the role of families cooking in the end can do more than chefs, because they're educating so deeply. They're not just heroes, they're moms and dads. So I think we need a combination of chefs who can inspire families to value that time together.
Thank you both so much for being with us today. Josh Vertel, who is the new president of Slow Food USA, and Ruth Reichel. Don't forget that even though we're talking about good food that's affordable, her magazine is called Gourmet, and maybe we can be both, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you again.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having us.